Okay, this hour we will take your phone calls with the paranormal investigator, Joe Nichol, here on Coast to Coast. And, of course, his website is his name, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And, by the way, they can get you a free copy of the Skeptical Inquirer magazine. I'm going to give you a phone number to call. You must leave your mailing address. You will not get a return call. 1-800-634-1610. 1-800-634-1610. Just leave your name and address, and they'll get you one free copy of the Skeptical Inquirer magazine. Welcome back. Joe Nichol is with us, and your phone calls. Joe, a couple more questions, and we'll go to the calls. Loch Ness Monster, what do you think of that?
Well, Nessie is is one of many creatures that's perceived in the world. I've been to Loch Ness and traveled across in a boat with sonar. I've done the same and at Lake Champlain, where Champ is loose, and all the way over to Lake Okanagan, British Columbia. I've been in many of these lakes, Lake Memphremagog and others. And again, I think people are seeing something. And at the risk of having Lauren Coleman say that I'm one theory fits all, but some of these cases, the Loch Ness, for example, you have cases where somebody's describing a long-necked, multi-humped, undulating, serpentine creature that may be, say, 30 feet long.
See, this may be, of all the creatures that you've investigated that may have a paranormal tone to it, this may be the most natural of them all. I think it's either a massive eel or a plesiosaur dinosaur that still somehow has, multiplied and bred over the millions of years.
Well, here's the problem with that. This is enough of a theory for one lake, but you've got all these other lakes. And this becomes pretty far-fetched to have a plesiosaur in each of them. But also, plesiosaurs, I just bought a plesiosaur fossil. Plesiosaurs date back millions of years, and so these lakes are all left over from the last ice age and are only about 10,000 or so years old. They're relatively recent. And getting a monster in the lake is a big problem. And getting it to produce itself and reproduce, eventually, if you have a breeding population, one of them will have to die, and its carcass could float up on the shore. But the image that I described to you, this long-necked undulating creature, there is something, and I've collected reports now. I got onto this from an old case in a river in Scotland, and then I had a New York State wildlife expert who was hiding in a duck blind on Lake Alice told me it was near dark, and he told me that he saw this. And he said it absolutely would make a believer out of you. Now, he stayed there long enough to see what it was. It was otters, plural, swimming in a line. Even one otter, these are fast-swimming creatures, one of them swimming really fast leaves a long wake and could give the illusion of a long creature. But imagine now a mother and, say, two or three pups swimming more or less in unison, or three or four juveniles playing follow the leader, as they do. And it's an incredible illusion. A guy was standing on a bluff near where Caddy the sea serpent is in British Columbia. He was on the next bay over, standing on a cliff looking down, and he said, "I'm a skeptic, and I saw Caddy. I saw this long undulating serpentine creature, and I watched it swim and swim and swim, and it went towards the shore, and then 1, 2, 3, 4 otters got out." I mean, it's just the damnedest thing.
Well, see, I would guess that Nessie is the least of the paranormal possibilities. I think it's whatever it is, that it's a natural creature, indigenous to this planet.
I think, to say to my friend Lauren, I'm not saying that all creatures, that all of the lake creatures are otters. Some are beavers. Some are cormorants or other birds that are doing something on the water, or a school of fish, or various large single fish at Lake Champlain. Just all kinds of possibilities. What I'm saying is if it has a long neck, if it is multi-humped, if I'm describing a particular type of creature, and then I say, then that's most likely to be otters swimming in a line. And their otters are, again, I did one of my distribution things. I did a map of North America, and I plotted about 100 lake and river monsters on it, and then I overlaid it with Audubon Society otter population, and voila. And again, I get, every time I do this, I get accused of saying, well, see, there you go again, they're all otters. No, no, I'm just saying that a lot of them could well be otters. And until we rule that out in a specific case, it's so much more likely than a plesiosaur.
What do you think of the existence, here you go, God?
Of God?
Mm-hmm.
God who?
Oh, boy.
Oh, okay, I got it.
Oh, boy.
But, well, I, you know, as a boy, I was a believer, and I was a Bible reader in our church, and it didn't hurt me. But I became a skeptic. I just think that, again, to say, because we don't know how we're here, and we're really mystified, therefore it must be a God. Well, then you have to ask, well, how did God get here? And it's just never ending. I see no evidence from the horrors of the world that someone benevolent is looking out for us. You have to really play the game of confirmation bias big time and say, well, you see, that one person was the airplane crashed, and that person survived. It's just a, you know, chance in a million. And so that's evidence of God. And then I would say, well, what about the 236 other people?
Yeah.
Well, God moves in mysterious ways. So.
Controversial, isn't it?
It is controversial. I'm just not a believer. And I don't try to disprove God anymore. You really can't prove a negative in the paranormal, because if you say that there are no leprechauns in Ireland, somebody will say, well, prove there aren't. And, well, you go on an expedition, and, you know, so, well, but don't you know the wee creatures are really over at Blarney Castle, don't you know? And it's never ending. And they, you know, then at last resort, they'll say, well, the creatures have the power of invisibility, don't you know? And you can't win if you play the game. So in science, the game is played this way. The person who makes the claim has to prove it is. No one has to prove it isn't. And they have to have something more than just, we don't know.
All right, back to the phones now we go. Let's go to Walt in Allentown, Pennsylvania to get started here. Go ahead, Walt.
Hi, George. It's great to be on with you again.
Hey, good to have you on.
Hey, I wholeheartedly agree with your guest. I think that we have to exhaust all the natural explanations before we resort to the supernatural explanations. Now, in ancient times, as I said to you in a previous call, George, there were no microscopes, there were no telescopes.
That's
the ignorance and mysticism ruled the day. When ancient man looked up at the clouds, well, he imagined pearly gates. And when ancient man viewed volcanic activity, well, he postulated, well, there must be a hell below us. So,
yeah, I think exactly right. I think that what's changed is that we've evolved, and we've created a civilization, and we're benefiting all the time from past knowledge because we're keeping a record of it. I said earlier that I regarded science as a series of solved mysteries, and it's true. I mean, just look at the incredible things that medical science is doing. Look at what we're doing, looking out into the universe, and we're flying around Jupiter. And I mean, it's just incredible. And we have a much better sense of what some things are than our ancient forebears did. But we're encountering new mysteries all the time, and I'm just suggesting that we always have to be careful about our bias and about wanting to believe in something. We have to start not with the answer that we want, whether you're a believer or a debunker. Don't start with the answer. Start with the evidence. Find more evidence. Look for corroborative evidence. Prioritize the evidence. Some evidence is better than others. Some may be a mistaken eyewitness on something. And then try to have the most reasonable, simple hypothesis according to the principle of Occam's razor, that not necessarily the simplest hypothesis, that could be deceptive, the one that makes the fewest assumptions, as let's say the plesiosaur idea with Loch Ness, that we have to assume a number of things that we don't have to assume if we invoke otters or some other creature.
What do you think of miracles, Joseph? Are they real?
Well, miracles really prove my point, because the way miracles are defined, and just go to any literature, any book on miracles, and they're defining it as something science can't explain. And you see the problem. As, again, this is a classy show, so I'll do it in Latin. Argumentum et ignorantium. Argument from ignorance.
Yeah.
We can't say that, but this is done, the Catholic Church, which invokes miracles to explain and to canonize saints, and I just have a new article in the New Skeptical Inquirer about a saint in Australia, Mary McKillop, and she's a wonderful person, and if the Catholic Church wanted a hardworking person and a devout, devoted person and who helped the poor, by all means, call her a saint and honor her. But no, they have to have a miracle, and the miracles are, well, Mrs. So-and-so thought she had this, and some of the doctors didn't think so, but we think it's a miracle, because doctors had to admit they just couldn't really say how that happened. Well, you my thought is that maybe she had an odd, this whoever the person who had the miracle was, maybe she had an odd genetic advantage, or maybe the body did something that was unusual, or maybe, and this is what I find when I investigate these miracle cases a lot of times, I find that there was prior medical treatment. And, maybe it kicked in a little late, George.
Maybe.
So we really can't say that because something is not explained. Now, miracles,
things happen.
I've looked at many of them. One that's really interested me some years ago was the miracle of the blood of San Gennaro, or St. Januarius in Naples, this liquefying blood that on certain occasions, this congealed blood will liquefy in front of the faithful. And it's impressive, and skeptics have tried to figure it out. Well, a forensic friend and I used a pigment, a blood-colored pigment, and olive oil, which is a non-drying oil, and a little bit of hot beeswax, all put together in a hot solution, so that when it cooled, there was just enough wax to cause the substance to congeal. But the slightest warmth that it would suddenly liquefy. And we've shown this and demonstrated this. And a friend of ours was able to get not the famous vial, but another vial doing a similar trick at a smaller church. And he was permitted to do some simple tests. And when he warmed it, the miracle occurred. So I think science is probably on to that trick. And if the church or any of the churches ever allow a vial to be opened and subjected to sophisticated modern analysis, I think we'll find that not one of those is pure blood, or even may have no blood in it.
Let's go to Bob in Chicago. Hi, Bob. Welcome to the program.
George, thank you, George, and thank you, Joe. Joe, I've got two questions. The first one is, what is your opinion on the Patterson-Gimlin Bigfoot case? And I really doubt that is a Bigfoot. They had Bob Hieronymus, he claimed that he was in that suit. He took a lie test and passed. And Gimlin refused to take the test. What is your opinion on that situation?
Well, like I say, I know Bob Gimlin, and Bob's just the nicest guy around, and I think Bob's going to go to his death defending his friend Roger, and he's not going to rat on him. That's what I think. And I call it Big Suit because I'm convinced it was a suit. I happen to know, personally, the man who sold the suit to Roger. His name's Phil Morris. And at the time, he was making gorilla suits and selling them to carnivals and B-grade movies and so forth. Now he has one of the world's largest costume shops, and he's a friend of mine. And Phil says that, and I believe him, he sold this suit, one of his standard gorilla suits, to Roger. And he also, Roger wanted some extra fake fur to go with it. And I think we know what Roger did with that. He modified the head to give it a more sagittal crest look, and he put those, which is genius, he put pendulous breasts on it, a female Bigfoot. In fact, people have said when they saw that, they said, you know, no hoaxer would ever think of putting breasts on Bigfoot. This is proof that it was real. But if you looked a year earlier at Roger Patterson's book, and Roger Patterson was a talented artist, he has a drawing of just that creature. So Roger knew what the creature was going to look like a year earlier. He was a repeater who had found Bigfoot tracks, and he who went to Bluff Creek on that day announcing that he was going to go film Bigfoot. And Bigfoot showed up. And I believe that Bob Hieronymus was in the suit. I think it's very likely. Because there are people still living who saw such a suit in the trunk of Bob's mother's car.
Ah.
And, you know, ah. I know you can do this, you know, the true believers become a kind of debunker when they need to. So as soon as you say, okay, well, here's the scenario like I just suggested, they become debunkers. Oh, well, we don't believe that. We think that Hieronymus was probably just lying to get some attention. And who knows what Phil Morris, we don't know him. He could probably just be looking for attention too. Maybe he sold it to somebody else. Who knows? And they end up, what they're doing, you see, is they're debunking the things they don't like. But we really shouldn't just pick evidence that we like or don't like. We should be able to say, as I just did, that there were people who saw that suit in the trunk of...
That's a great part of the story. Joe, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and wrap things up with final phone calls. Joe Nickel with us, the paranormal investigator, next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, our final segment here with Joe Nickel. Joe, tell us about the Imagine No Religion Conference.
That's the one in Vancouver, right?
I think so. Are you going to be at that?
I've been to one of those before, and I'm not, you know, a regular. I just was one time.
Do you debunk them? I use that word, Joe.
No, they
treated
me very, very nicely, and I was able to piggyback some of my British Columbia research. See, whenever I go somewhere exotic, and let me define that, that's outside Buffalo, somewhere exotic, I try to look and see what I might look into and investigate. So I've done this around the world in Peru and Austria and Hungary and Australia and New Zealand, and go to conferences and spend a little extra time on my own dime and investigate things to bring back.
What drives you, Joe? What keeps pushing you in this? Seeking the truth? Is that what you're after? What is it?
I am after the truth, and I'm also, and I say this, I'll lower my voice because I don't want, you know, everybody to hear me say this.
Right, just whisper.
But I try to have some fun. The problem with people who are debunkers is that they're not having fun. They become increasingly strident.
Mm-hmm.
Angry, and they eventually burn out. I've just watched a couple of prominent skeptics, I believe, are on the verge of doing that. They finally say, oh, all those ghosts, all those haunted houses, you've seen one, you've seen them all, I'm tired of it, and so forth. Why hasn't that happened to me? Well, because with them, I think, yeah, you're probably right. I think there probably aren't any real ghosts, though I could be wrong.
And that's what drives you. There could be.
That I'm curious. I'm not really expecting that, well, I'll just find a ghost over the next, tomorrow, maybe in that house. No, what I'm doing is I'm curious as to what makes people tick. What is the mystery that caused people to hear my very first case? I've mentioned this to you before. McKenzie House in Toronto, people hearing footsteps on the stairs late at night when there was no one there. Well, I go to the haunted house, and lo and behold, next door, 40 inches away, is a parallel iron staircase and a late night cleanup crew. And, it made the case for me. I knew right then, this is what you do. You have to get up out of your armchair. You have to actually go and investigate. Sometimes I wear disguises. I use subterfuge to get close, and I've exposed a number of phony psychics that way. But I'm having fun doing it. I find it interesting. It's a challenge to think, what investigative strategy could I use here? So once I solved the Atlanta House of Blood mystery, using blood pattern analysis, and showed that
real science.
The blood wasn't coming out of the walls, as people said, and springing up from the floor. The elderly couple was looking for attention, and they had splattered it onto the surfaces, and we could prove this in a court of law. So I'm interested in solving mysteries because it's what we do as detectives. I knew I was a detective when I was 8 years old. And so I have fun, I'm curious, but I believe that mysteries are not something to be kept endlessly mysterious and used to promote, using false logic of an argument from ignorance, used to promote some belief. I believe, this is shocking, I know, but I believe that mysteries are meant to be solved.
Good for you. I agree. Let's go to Manhattan, Kansas. Rick's with us. Rick, take it away.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, Rick.
Hey,
I knew you were going to call, Rick. My psychic told me that. Well, I got to laugh.
I'm a devout Celtic pagan, and I have a question for you or a comment. If you don't believe that there's a God, like Jehovah or whatever,
How do you explain nature, Joe?
Well, I don't have to explain it, you see, because, again, you're getting close to that argument from ignorance, Rick. You're saying if we don't know what caused nature to come into being, therefore it must be God, and then you have to ask the same thing, where did God come from, and you're back, you didn't make very much gain. I think that there always was something. I don't think the universe might have come and someday it'll go, but I believe that there was something before that and before that. I believe that nothingness is an impossibility. Never was nothingness.
No, I can't comprehend nothingness. Can you?
Yeah, I think not. So before one universe was maybe another, maybe there are lots of universes like bubbles. But anyway, I just used the believe word, and I try to avoid that as much as possible. But I meant I reasonably infer or think rather than believe.
You will admit, though, Joe, that life itself is very not only complex and unusual, but amazingly fascinating.
It is. I also am sure that it evolved, and so the evidence for that's not in question. It's a fact that we've evolved, and so yeah, it's amazing to look at that and to see how the evolution has happened, and we're supposedly a higher form, though sometimes George, I wonder.
You never know.
Who we are.
Pat is with us, Northridge, California, first-time caller. Thanks for calling, Pat. Go ahead.
Hi, George.
Hey, hi.
Well, I have a ghost story. Your guest doesn't believe in ghosts.
He does not. No. Well, I'll let him say that himself. Okay, go ahead.
Well, I was a caregiver for a gentleman, and my shift was from 6 at night to 6 in the morning. So I put the gentleman to bed, and I went through the house, turned off all the lights and the TV, and made sure everything was locked up good, and I went to bed. The next thing I know, I hear the refrigerator door opening up, cupboards opening and closing. And so I get up to see what's going on, and I go into the den, and all the lights are on, and the TV is blasting. So I turn everything off. Anyway, I managed to make it through the night. And in the morning, I get the gentleman up, and we're walking down the hallway to the kitchen, and it's freezing. That area is freezing. And there's a mirror at the end of the hallway, and I look up, and there's a woman walking with us.
Whoa, what'd she look like?
She had blonde hair. She looked like she was in her 30s, maybe 40s.
Did she look ghostly?
No, she had an actual human figure. But when I looked over at the gentleman to see if she was walking with us, there was nobody there. But she was in the mirror.
All right. Now, Joe, how would you handle that? Would you say that Pat is hallucinating or what?
Just to start off, this is what's called an anecdote. The woman has told a story. I wasn't there. She cannot prove her story, so we don't really have evidence that you could take to a court. And these kinds of cases don't usually go very far.
Now, would you say that you believe her, though, with what she thinks she saw?
I don't know. I do tend to believe her, but she seemed very interested in being a storyteller, and so I expect it might have been colored a little bit. It might have improved over the years. The questions I would have would be, was there anyone else in the house? Could the person she was giving care to have gotten up half awake and fumbled around in the kitchen and left some lights on and the fridge door open? I don't know, but that's much more likely because if we make a list again, ghosts are going to be way at the bottom of the list. They don't exist. Science can't find them. It's really not a credible idea. As to the apparition of the figure, whether in a mirror or not, apparitions appear to be a trick of the mind. What's happening is when you imagine something wells up from your subconscious, an image, it's happening in your mind. Visual scene is also happening in your brain, and you can get the equivalent, I like to use this analogy, of a double exposure with a camera. You can get a mental image from your subconscious. Maybe you weren't consciously thinking of a ghost, but something in the scene or something triggered the thought unconsciously, and it's for a moment. Usually apparitions are very brief, and for a moment your mind was tricked in confusing what you imagined and in putting it onto the visual scene, if I'm explaining that clearly. So it's like a double exposure. I think they're very common, and I think you're apt to do it when you're tired or doing something boring or routine, not doing something intense and lively. And people have these apparitional experiences. But they're just that. They're a type of little trick of the mind.
Have you put people on lie detector tests?
I don't believe that lie detectors detect lies. I think they detect emotions that may sometimes indicate a lie, but I don't think they're accurate. Studies of lie detectors are not very hopeful, and the number of people who we know have passed lie detectors only to prove absolutely they're guilty remains a counter argument. So it's a nice idea that the lie detector, the cardiopneumopsychograph, can really detect lies. Would that it were true, but It really can't.
Let's go to Jim in Billings, Montana. Go ahead, Jim.
Hey, George, how you doing this morning?
Good, Jim. Thank you.
Good. Yeah, I was trying to get on your show once before, but we had bad cell phone connection, but that's okay. I can live with that. I was watching Destination America. There's some Bigfoot hunters out there.
Sure.
And they had one that was called a Kentucky Whistler. And then they had another one that was called a Yahoo.
That's right.
And I'm laughing, you know, and I'm going, where do they come up with these names? Well, I've tried to hunt a couple myself, you know, which is kind of, you know, where I've been raised in California, but we never had any out there that I knew of. Well, I went with some friends that we were in Kentucky at my brother's house, John, and we went out one night, went looking, and we were able to see remnants of something out there. We don't know what it is. I mean,
well, there you go.
Could have been a bear, right?
There you go. You see, you don't know what it was. You saw something. The least likely thing that was a Bigfoot. We don't know that Bigfoot exists, so you have to make a lot of supposings and a lot of inferences and a lot of guesses and so forth. But it's just more likely that it was some critter that you didn't know what it was.
Is it possible, Joe, we only got a minute left, is it possible that Bigfoot could be a creature on this planet, an animal that we just haven't found yet?
Yes, it's possible, but it's very, very, very unlikely, because we should, if the evidence that we have that this is so, which is what motivates us, as I indicated earlier, is all, in every state, it's everywhere, it's Bigfoot sightings are plentiful, and yet we don't have one. More likely, it would be like the panda, where you have a remote area, and it's only seen in the remote area by the locals.
Good point. Good point indeed. Hey, Joe, we're out of time. I want to thank you for being on the program. Always great having you on, my friend. Joe Nickel, website is his name. And there's two L's in Nickel, by the way. So make sure you go and see some of the things he does. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burles, and George Knapp. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.